you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us today on what is our 39th anniversary of Air Talk. Air Talk started April 1st, 1985. I was 26 years old, wondering if listeners would pay any attention to a program that at the time was on every evening, talking with newsmakers and talking with authors of new books, talking about issues of the day. The first week, much like the program that we do now 39 years later. And fortunately, people have been listening. Our audience has grown. And what is today LAist is many, many, many times what it was when the little KPCC started with Air Talk back in 1985. But here we are 39 years later, to my knowledge, the longest running daily talk program in the history of Los Angeles by quite a wide margin. And I would have never guessed when I started at that point that I would still be hosting, we'd still be doing a program much like it was at the start, though with a much bigger staff, many more topics each day, expanded number of hours. I couldn't have guessed that here we would be in the year 2024. So good to have you with us today. And if you celebrated Easter yesterday and observed the holiday, I hope it was a good one for you. We had family in town, had a very nice gathering at my mother's. I hope if you observed the day and celebrated it yesterday, it was a good one for you. Coming up on the program today, two Southern California history segments, one on the fascinating history of Terminal Island, which was a Bohemian and Japanese-American community in Los Angeles for many, many years, very different than the highly industrialized place that we know today as Terminal Island in the L.A. Harbor. We're also going to be talking about the L.A. River. L.A. Times writer Pat Morrison will be with us to talk about the history of the L.A. River, its importance to the earliest residents of Southern California, and then, of course, the weather conditions which led it finally to be channelized in its present form, and we'll open it up for listeners to weigh in on their favorite parts of the LA River and what they feel is their relationship to it. But we begin with all the dramatics surrounding March Madness, the women's game, where we have two prime matchups in the Elite Eight tonight. Beginning this afternoon, it's Iowa against LSU, and you could not have a better matchup in women's basketball than those two, followed by USC and the University of Connecticut. Both of those, UConn and USC, are powerhouses as well. So it's going to be a terrific night of basketball. Those games broadcast on ESPN from Albany and from Portland. Joining us to talk about what's happening with March Madness women's basketball and also the controversy surrounding LSU and its lightning rod of a coach, Kim Mulkey, is Miriam Swanson, sports columnist for the Southern California News Group, which includes the Orange County Register, LA Daily News, and many other papers. Miriam, so good to have you with us. Good morning.
Good morning, and congratulations on 39 years. That's
Thank
awesome.
You. Thank you so much. It's fun to work with people. You know, most of the people here are younger than the show is, including all of my producers who were not born when we first went
wow.
on the air.
That's amazing. As an avid listener, I thank all of you.
Well, thank you, Mary. Appreciate it so much. Well, could we have a more exciting March Madness for women? This tournament is great.
It's amazing, and I love that the world in America is so tuned in and hyped for it. It's pretty wild, but the quality of play. I mean, I've talked to different coaches, and everyone seems to think that this might be the greatest tournament ever. But I think in all the ways, both from interest to the caliber of play to the parity to the big names, and it's pretty cool.
And let's talk about the matchups. First of all, our own USC, which has its own star player on the court against UConn tonight. You know, give us the thumbnail of this game tonight.
So that's happening up in Portland. UConn is, of course, you know, the perennial power, but it's not quite the perennial power that it always has been, because, you know, South Carolina showed up and Iowa showed up and LSU showed up, and now suddenly you have USC and UCLA knocking on the door too, and there's a lot more parity, and it isn't not all of the great players in the country all go to the same school anymore, which makes it really interesting and fun. So they're led by Paige Beckers, who is a really outstanding, really fun to watch player. She's had injuries, so this is like a year where she's not been injured, and she's really, or she's healthy now anyway, and she's showing what she can do, and she's putting up crazy numbers in the tournament. Her team is still banged up though, so they're not that deep, but they go up against USC. Juju Watkins is LA girl. She is a phenom. She played at Sierra Canyon. Even when she was there, people were as excited about her, not more, than Bronny.
She lights it up. She's second leading scorer this year, isn't she?
Yeah, right behind Caitlin Clark. And she's just a joy to watch. She's so cool. She's got so many moves. She's such a competitor. If you haven't watched her yet, you have to watch her. Go see her live. It's really, she's special. And the team around her is great. They recruited three Ivy League grad students. So, you know, they've been referred to over the course of the season as Juju and the Nerds, or Juju and the Ivies. I think Coach Gottlieb prefers now, but
Nerd is embraced by so many people. I'm surprised they would run from that. That's badge
girls,
of honor now.
No, the girls of themselves love it. They're girls from they graduates of Harvard and Penn and Columbia, and they can hoop, and they've been perfect complement to Juju. And they won the Pac-12. You know, they were ranked, I think, 21st to start the year. I finished the season ranked third, maybe, or I forget exactly, but in the top five. And now they're, knocking on the door for a Final Four, which they hadn't been back to the NCAA tournament since like 1994 until last year. So, or something like that. So it's, or 2000. Anyway, it was a long time.
And of course, USC with a great history of women's basketball over the years. But the sport is so much bigger now than it was at that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, but then, of course, they've really leaned into the history and the legacy of the program too. And a lot of those players, the Cheryl Millers and Tina Thompsons, Lisa Leslie's, have lent their support to this year's team too. So it's been really cool to see sort of this cross-generational embrace that really, you know, celebrates what's happening now and what happened before. And, you know, it's all working together.
Earlier in my career, when I did some sports announcing, I actually called a game featuring Cheryl Miller, and man, she's great. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Tremendous player. And of course we've got Caitlin Clark, who, I don't know, was Sue Bird the last player to get this level of attention as a women's player?
Probably Sue Bird, Dinah Taurasi.
Yeah, Taurasi too. Yeah,
but I feel like Caitlin probably has exceeded it. I mean, if you look at the numbers of people that are watching her games, it's bigger than anything that's ever happened for women's basketball. I mean, they had 12.6 million at its peak last championship game, and that game averaged like 9.9 million viewers, which I think the previous high ever was like a UConn game. Those are probably like Taurasi and Sue Bird era, and that had like 5.6 million. So Caitlin Clark has done something very, very different.
And of course, Angel Reese for the LSU Tigers as they match up with Iowa tonight. Your thoughts about this game and the blood, so to speak, between the two teams. This going to be a highly physical game, you think?
I think, at this point, all these games are, and I expect this one will be too. I think it will live up to the hype just like it did last year. LSU got really hot from three last year, which was sort of uncharacteristic, but that's what the basketball gods gave us. And Iowa couldn't keep up, which was funny because Iowa's, you know, the nation's top scoring team. And Caitlin Clark is, of course, famous for her shooting from deep, and the rest of the team can shoot too. So, you know, if LSU gets gets it going from three or something like that happens, then, you know, that will have something to do with it. But as far as it being physical and the blood between them, I find that there, I think there's just a ton of respect. I think they're really hard-nosed competitors. I don't think it's bad blood at all. I think they enjoy like being able to go out and you know, jaw at each other and have fun that way. And that's part of what makes this particular matchup so compelling and fun is sort of that level of play.
Yeah, we're talking with Miriam Swanson, sports columnist for the Southern California News Group, which includes the San Gabriel Valley Tribune, the Daily Breeze, Orange County Register, LA Daily News, and a number of other local publications. If you have questions about March Madness, the women's game, and these great matchups in the Elite Eight that are tonight in Albany, New York, and in Portland, we're at 866-893-5722. You can also email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. I did want to ask you about the coach of LSU, Kim Mulkey, who was criticizing a Washington Post profile of her before it was even published. She joins a long line of coaches to criticize profiles of them before they've even read the piece and before it's even been published. And then, of course, going after Ben Bolch's column in the Los Angeles Times, where he set this up when UCLA was playing them as sort of a battle of good versus evil and putting the villain hat onto LSU and the good folks on UCLA. And the Times went back and re-edited that piece, made some changes, removed the description of LSU as dirty debutantes and some others. Your thoughts on Mulkey and her saying that the column was sexist?
So yeah, when I first read the piece, I had basically all of the same thoughts that Kim Mulkey had, and it was sort of surprising to read it. And so I think she being Kim Mulkey, is not shy to make those sort of points in the most public way possible, which I think is what makes her a compelling figure, whether you agree with everything or anything that she says. As far as I find LSU gets it's very interesting and kind of disheartening the characterization that LSU has gotten, not just from that Times article, but across the board for the last year and change. I watched them live for the first time when they played, you know, I've been watching them on TV for a while now, obviously, but I watched them live for the first time against UCLA the other night, and I just kind of like fell in love with this team. Like, they're everything that I want from a basketball team. They're obviously incredibly skilled, so competitive, such good basketball, great execution, but they play with so much energy and passion and joy. They're just absolute performers, and it was so much fun. And how anyone can look at that and think that that's bad or evil or bad for women's basketball. I mean, there's definitely some trash talking and whatnot involved, but I'm someone who enjoys that in basketball. So, and think that the women should get to do it if the men do. I've never seen anyone tweet about, you know, LeBron said a bad word and that's going to be, you know, that makes him a villain. Or Kobe for that matter. I think this particular story was sort of one in a long line of sort of commentary on LSU. And I don't know more than that, but I agreed with a lot of what Mulkey had to say.
I just have to say, because I wouldn't have the same degree of sensitivity as a man reading the piece, I was sort of taking it like how the Oakland Raiders used to sort of, you know, wear their black hat, you know, sort of proudly as the outlaw team, as the, you know, the ones who would say anything and be outspoken I was sort of taking it more in that vein as almost an entertaining thing than like an indictment that they're dirty or bad or whatever. But again, I wouldn't have the same sensitivity as a man reading that piece as you and other women were. Is there any comparison to some of those teams?
Well, what's interesting, I think, about that is that sort of like Caitlin Clark doesn't get that characterization, and LSU often does. You know, she's she's not considered sort of the black hat villain, even though she talks as much trash and, you know, will wave off a player, I'm not going to guard you, or she'll, you know, go to the crowd and, you know, raise her arms and ask them to cheer. She's a killer, man. Like the other night against Colorado, the moment she could feel the game turning, she like got the crowd, got her teammates, like everything, like to that extra push, similar to what LSU does. And so, yeah, I think they're
so you don't see it as equal in how they're being treated.
Yeah, I think LSU especially sort of gets this heel, like it's. But I don't know that they're at. I mean, they'll wear it if they have. You know, said, we'll take that hit, and we'll be the good villains. But it's just, you know, I don't know, like, why they have to be the villains.
They are entertaining, and as you say, I was talking with colleagues this morning when we were talking about this segment, and I said this reminds me a little bit of the shift that the NBA underwent. You know, the NBA, sort of the players of, you know, Elgin Baylor's era, they're sort of, you know, very upright, and you know, there wasn't the degree of sort of public trash talking, you know, and the NBA became this much more big personality league, and players, you know, that huge personalities, and became much more entertaining from the personal side of it. And are you seeing that at all in the women's, or is it not really comparable to that sort of a shift?
No, I feel like that's a great point, actually. I think that as it grows, I guess it's going to have some growing pains, and people are going to experience it for the first time or experience it differently than before. And you're seeing more personalities. I don't know that. I mean, I was talking to my colleague Elliot Tieford earlier today, and he was talking about covering USC Long Beach State games back in back in Cheryl Miller's era, like the early 80s. And he said, "Oh, the trash talk you heard there." And like those teams really hated each other, and it was like what's happening now pales compared to that. So, but the audience is different.
It's a really good point. I remember seeing Denise Curry at UCLA, and you know, these these great players, and yeah, they didn't back down from anybody, had big personalities. So it's an excellent point, but we're sure paying a lot more attention now. Miriam, thanks so much for joining us, and you know, what a great assignment you have to be able to cover this and to write about women's basketball during March Madness.
Yeah, I'm a lucky woman. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it's great. Thanks so much, Miriam Swanson. You read her, sports columnist in the Southern California News Group series of papers, including the Orange County Register, the Daily Breeze, the LA Daily News, Pasadena Star News, San Gabriel Valley Tribune, and many others. It's Air Talk on LA's 89.3. Coming up, we'll talk about a CalMatters deep dive into the dramatic increase in the number of deaths in state jails and prisons in California. That's all coming up in just 1 minute on Air Talk.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
It's Air Talk on LA's 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. Two Southern California history segments today. We do one every Monday, but today we've got a double helping, a bonus. We're going to be talking about the history, remarkable history it is, of Terminal Island in the Los Angeles Harbor, and we'll talk about the LA River. From vital source for the original residents of Los Angeles to channelized, you know, flood control, for LA as it sits now, but with parts of it that are being redeveloped into parkland, and there's even a hope that some of the concrete might be removed for some stretches of the LA River. We'll talk about that, but right now we turn our attention to California jails. They're holding thousands fewer people, but the death rate in jails has gone up. Governor Newsom, according to a CalMatters piece almost 5 years ago, said the state would be much more closely involved in preventing deaths in the 57 jail systems run by California County sheriffs. But more people have been dying every year since. Joining us, reporter from CalMatters, justice reporter Nigel Duara. Nigel, so good to have you with us. Thanks so much for joining us to talk about this important piece in CalMatters.
Hi, Larry. Thanks so much for having me.
Quantify, please, the increase that we've seen in deaths for those in custody in jails.
Sure. So there was a record year in 2022 of 215 deaths. But before you get there, you have to understand that right before the pandemic shut down, Governor Newsom kind of made a pledge to reduce jail deaths. And one thing that we focused on was that, as you noted in the intro, the number of people in jail has gone down, but the rate of death, and in some cases the raw numbers of deaths, have gone up.
And to what is this being attributed? Is fentanyl one of the culprits? Because we're seeing increasing deaths from fentanyl overdoses in a wide range of environments and populations. Is that one of the major drivers of the death rate?
Yes, definitely. Fentanyl replacing methamphetamine in jails was one cause of the increase in overdose deaths that we saw in jails. Another big one was suicides. And someone might ask, well, what can they do about that? And in our reporting and in the series that we're working on that's still coming out, we've seen different measures that can be used to address suicide, like looking for self-harm signifiers at intake or having the correctional folks check on them at unpredictable times so that they can't just wait to the last check and attempt to harm themselves. One of the things we saw that was a big factor in this was burnout among medical staff. During the pandemic especially, they felt in interviews that their job, ability to do the job, was constrained, and they were burning out. So when you have more experienced folks with more institutional memory leaving these jobs, being replaced perhaps by people with less experience, that can have an impact also on overall what they call natural cause deaths, or people who die in jail of something other than suicide or drug overdoses.
I don't have the numbers in front of me, but my sense is we have seen an increase in suicides among young men. And I wonder if part of what we're seeing in the jail, because young men are, of course, the largest demographic in jail, could we be seeing the increase in suicide tied to a larger societal risk of that?
Well, it's certainly possible. I don't know that that was necessarily a focus of our investigation, but that's certainly possible that the groups that we saw increase the most in this period, which again is from 2021 until the end of 2023, the groups we saw going up the most were men about under age 25 or senior men. So that wasn't all just suicides, but those were certainly the two cohorts that we saw big increases in.
All right. And what are the protocols that most of these county jails employ to try and, well, let's talk drugs first, to try and prevent fentanyl or methamphetamine or other drugs getting behind bars with those being held?
Sure. So they have, you know, each jail has its own procedure. Each jail is run by the sheriff in the way that they see fit, as long as it, you know, complies with California law. So in terms of protocols for drugs, you know, you can imagine they do searches, they do cavity searches, they search your stuff. What we're hearing from sheriffs, at least in terms of drugs and especially fentanyl, is people who bring it in inside their bodies, there's nothing they can really do about that, they say, and other ways that it gets over. One sheriff was telling me that he has to keep an eye out for drones bringing drugs or other contraband over the walls and dropping it in the yard before anyone can see it, and these folks grab it, and then it gets in the jails.
Really?
Is in folks are worried about deputies bringing in drugs
and then selling them to those being held. And then, you know, when it comes to suicide, we hear about suicide watch, for example, for people that are despondent or have a history of suicide attempts. Are there general protocols generally employed in jails to try and protect people from self-harm?
Sure. So that, again, starts at intake. And that's one area that critics say could really be improved. If somebody comes in and they're seated in a little plastic chair and they're being asked questions, you know, by a medical person, but there's a line of deputies behind them and everyone's watching them and it's out in public, they may not say what prescription drugs they're on or what illegal drugs they're on or their history of self-harm because they don't want to air that out there. That can be a problem. And so that's one place where folks have said, maybe we can improve that. Beyond that, in terms of suicide prevention, what we've at least seen in our reporting is that the jails that stagger the visits and the checks, the in-cell checks by the deputies, that can, if you stagger that and change it, that can make it less predictable. And by doing that, they've actually caught folks in a place like Tulare County. They've caught folks attempting to harm themselves and stop them in the process.
We're talking with Nigel Dwara, who's justice reporter for Cal Matters, who's done this fascinating deep dive into the serious problem of deaths that have increased, sometimes in just real numbers, as Nigel was saying, in other cases per capita, for those that have been held in jails in the county facilities, either through suicides or overdoses or what are classified as natural causes. Also with us is the Sheriff of Riverside County, Chad Bianco. Sheriff, thank you for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
What are you seeing in Riverside County jails?
Well, we're seeing everything that Nigel just explained. And for as we get going, I've never met Nigel. My first introduction to him was listening to him talk right now. And for the work that he does, we unbelievably appreciate it. It's certainly needed and for us to keep an eye on and everything else. But as I'm listening to both of you talk and some of the words that we use, I think we have to really take a 30,000 foot view at this and see if it really is that big of a problem. Yes, they're going up. The death rate or the deaths in custody went up. But just off of the numbers that Nigel said, the 250 deaths, and we have roughly 100,000 inmates, that's a quarter of 1%. A quarter of 1% of the inmates died in custody. And I want to really emphasize, they're not dying because they're in jail. They're dying while they are in jail. So Riverside County was no different than anywhere across the country. Over the last couple of years, we've had an increase in our average. So our average was 9, and in 2022, we actually went to 18. And historically, we've always been the lowest of the five counties in Southern California. And this particular year, we were one more than we were the most, but everybody was up at that same number. And so when we talk about that and we think about what we're doing, everything that Nigel was saying about the intakes and what you do when you interview them and all of those things and the medical and the mental, all of that is happening. I want to really emphasize, we don't sit there with the nurse unless it's an emergency with a person fighting. The nurse has that person by themselves. The mental health clinician has that person by themselves. The deputy isn't standing there watching. They're sitting in an office and they're doing their initial evaluations. Whether or not a person is truthful with you, we can never anticipate, or we can never assume that they're going to be truthful. But we definitely, we do everything we can, and it almost seems like, and I've said this numerous times, we do everything we can to save them from themselves. We had the 18 deaths that we had in 2022, but if you talk about the suicides and the fentanyl overdoses, we saved about 240. Between suicide and fentanyl that we revived after they had either hung themselves and they were out and we had to revive them with CPR, or we are completely, all of our deputies and our nurses are outfitted and they carry Narcan. So we are constantly dosing them when they are unconscious and we're bringing them back. So, you know, we lost 18 in 2022. We unfortunately,
I think we just lost the sheriff. His line just disconnected. We'll try and get him back to finish his point because I have so many questions to follow up with him. So we'll try and get him back. Let me go back to Nigel Dwara, who's justice reporter for Cal Matters. Nigel, just a quick response to what Sheriff Bianco in Riverside County was saying.
Sure. And of course, I'd love to let him finish his points. To the number, I think to his question about the numbers and the 0.25 of 1%, for us, the question was, what is the rate increase? For us, the question was, how are things changing? So when you see a pledge at the state level for things to go down, you see the number of inmates in jail going down, the number of deaths going up, that definitely piqued our curiosity. When you look at the rates of death, and we tried to make this point more on social media, Rikers Island is held up as this sort of awful place where lots of people die. There are several jails in California with rates of death during this period that were worse than Rikers. So yes, by looking at the total deaths and looking at the total inmate population, it may not look as bad, but the question is, how good of a job are we doing in the jails of preventing suicides? How good of a job are we doing of helping folks who do have existing health conditions stay alive? If there were a hospital losing this many people, if there were suicide wards losing this many people to suicide, would we say that there's a problem? So I think that that's part of the question. Yeah. I'd love to see when he gets back.
Well, and I think we have Sheriff Bianco back. And I just, I'm sorry that your line disconnected. We lost you, Sheriff, but I'm glad we have you back. So you were talking about all the people that have been saved who had attempted suicide or had overdosed on fentanyl or other drugs and were revived using Narcan or CPR in the case of those who had attempted to hang themselves. And Sheriff, is that in the number of attempted suicides, in the number of overdoses, is that up versus attempts and overdoses in the past?
It is slightly up. And so the overdose one is big. In 2022, we had 7 fentanyl deaths that were directly related to fentanyl. So fentanyl is a game changer because no longer do they overdose on heroin and you revive them, or they really come out of it, or it's easier to revive. An overdose on fentanyl is more often than not fatal. And so when you have 7 fentanyl overdoses, that's 7 deaths that we wouldn't normally have. So that puts us right back to average. And I don't know what the rest of the state is with their total numbers of fentanyl, but substantially the greatest cause of death in Riverside County jails is fentanyl.
And I wonder in the case of Rikers Island, because Nigel was just mentioning that, I don't know if the rates of fentanyl use is largely the same across the country or New York is here. Do you have any sense of that, Sheriff?
It's the same. So fentanyl, everyone experienced across the country, whether it's police departments that had local in custodies or whether it's sheriffs or state prisons that have the main correctional facilities, everyone experienced major increases in the numbers of deaths. And largely across the board, it's the influx of fentanyl and it's the use of fentanyl. I don't know the exact numbers of percentages and things like I can't say every jail has more fentanyl deaths. It's certainly that's what our main driver of deaths is fentanyl.
We're almost out of time, but I want to ask you, Sheriff Bianco, what is your office doing in response to this increase that you're seeing pretty dramatic in your county of the death rate in jail? How are you responding to that? What changes?
Yeah, well, the changes we're just as diligent as we possibly can to make sure that we're doing everything we possibly can to prevent them from committing suicide or from stopping the fentanyl from coming into the jails. And I appreciate Nigel caring about the percentages rather than the numbers. But percentages, if you have 2 and then you jump to 4, you had 100% increase. But the numbers are relative to the total population. The percentage is very deceiving when you think, oh, we had 100% increase, but it was only 2. And those aren't the numbers in this. But that's the danger of using percentages rather than whole numbers compared to a full population.
The LAS Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you 1 entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAS.com/sweeps.
So of our 60,000 inmates that we have in custody every year in Riverside County, we had our average was 10 and we had 18 die. Okay. So it was almost 100% increase. But it's just unfortunate. And
you're saying it's largely fentanyl. Sheriff, I'm so sorry. I need to conclude, but I want to thank you for being with us, Sheriff of Riverside County, Chad Bianco, with us. And our thanks to Justice Reporter for CalMatters, Nigel Duaro. And you can read Nigel's piece at CalMatters website. We also have a link to it from our AirTalk page at LAIS.com/AirTalk. Coming up, we talk about Southern California history, as we do every Monday, the history of Terminal Island, a new book, Terminal Island, Lost Communities on America's Edge. We'll talk with the co-authors when we come back in 90 seconds. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. The first of two Southern California history segments today. Next hour, it's Pat Morrison on the LA River. But right now, it's a brand new book, fascinating and with extraordinary photos, Terminal Island, Lost Communities on America's Edge. And I'm so pleased to have the co-authors of the book with us, Naomi Hirahara and Geraldine Natz. Geraldine is professor of practice at USC. Naomi and Geraldine, so good to have you both with us today. Several months ago, my wife and I decided we were going to drive around Terminal Island and look for the history of the Japanese American community that was there until World War I. And there are wonderful markers and photographs of what that community liked, descriptions, even the business stretch that was there and what happened. But there's so much more than even that, because in this new book, you see the Bohemian community that was there as well as the Japanese American community that was to come. Naomi, it's just, you know, it's a remarkable history of this little strip of land.
It's really wonderful, and I'm so honored that Angel City Press had invited me to be part of this. But I will have to say my co-writer, Geraldine Natz, who was the former port director, she was the one who got this whole project rolling, and she did the deep dive in the Bohemian era, the Rattlesnake Island, she did the deep dive on all that, and I... as the former editor of a Japanese American newspaper, I did the closer look at Terminal Island as a Japanese fishing colony,
which is an extraordinary history. And thankfully, we now have, you have to go look for it, as you and I were talking, unless you're a truck driver going down to Terminal Island, you're not going to see it. But if you go looking for it, you will see these spots with photos of what that area looked like when the Japanese American community was there. Geraldine, let's talk a bit about that Bohemian era. What was it that attracted artists and the like to go to Terminal Island, and how did that connect up with the arts culture in the Arroyo area of Northeast LA and Pasadena?
Well, that's a really interesting story. And I think what actually happened is when the Army engineers built that first breakwater from what was Rattlesnake Island at the time to Dead Man's Island, a whole bunch of sand started to build up along that breakwater. And so, you know, people moved there because it was like free property. They literally were squatters. They built these homes on stilts. And at one point, Charles Lummis, who was, you know, in the Arroyo area north of Los Angeles and, you know, the founder of the Southwest Museum, and he collected, you know, he was great for bringing together the artistic community and the writers in Los Angeles. He's at one point announced that he was going down there to basically grab a spot of you know, beachfront property. And so that sort of started an avalanche of others trying to come down there and do that. And I think to me what was most fascinating was that the women that were down there, the women took an old bathhouse and converted it into a literary retreat. And they would go down there and they would write. You know, you had a publisher down there. It was even a place where Jack London's wife retreated to after she separated from him when he was in Japan. And so it's kind of a remarkable history. And I think very few people knew this history was on Terminal Island, because, you know, if you look at the port today, you know, at Terminal Island, it's pretty much all container facilities.
Yeah.
But as you say, you drove around there, you know, the monument to the Fisherman's Village is there, and you sort of have to know it's there. And, you know, finally there's some signage up there. But if you know, you can also find what was the main drag, Tuna Street.
Yeah, and I love that, driving down that. Yeah.
Yeah, there's still two buildings that were not demolished when they plowed down all of the Japanese village. There's still two buildings. They're boarded up. Mm-hmm. I went over there about a month ago to check, make sure they were still there.
Let's hope they're protected, because they are such an important part of history. Naomi, when do Japanese American immigrants start arriving and making this fishing village at Terminal Island?
Well, some early ones were there. They came to work on the railroad because the story of Terminal Island is very connected to that. But many
That's why
of,
it's Terminal Island, exactly, right? It's the terminus of the railroad.
Definitely. Many of them came from this area of Japan called Wakayama Prefecture, and that is already known as a fishing area. So they brought this technique of fish and line, special kind of fishing technique, in which it's kind of chumming. You would throw out live bait and have a barbless hook, and then you're able to snag a big fish like a tuna, and you whip your wrist back and the fish goes back onto your deck. And up to that time, with the Italian and Yugoslavian fishermen, they didn't really know how to handle big fish like tuna. Sardines, other things, mackerel, you could use a big net to, but with larger fishes, you could kind of harm the flesh and make it look unattractive. So with this kind of expertise, a lot of the canneries, they kind of recognize, oh, so this is a group of people who have this kind of expertise. So it was about 1916 when the canneries started to become more established in this man-made, you know, everything's kind of man-made or tinkered into Fish Harbor. And so they just started hiring all these Japanese, actually kind of families.
Because, who had this expertise.
Yeah, and the women also were part of the operation because they would work inside of the canneries on the line. And so there were special kind of horns for each cannery. So when a fresh catch came in for a certain company, the horn would sound, and the women would, you know, don their rubber boots and their
clean
aprons.
The fish,
right,
and get them in the cans. And, yeah.
And since there were like 300 to 400 units, you know, housing that was all next to each other, you know, if you had children, and many of them did at 2, 3, you know, even more, they would just ask their neighbor, hey, can you watch my kids? I have to go to work.
Did kids also start working even as kids?
No.
They didn't do that.
It was more like as teenagers, okay, you know, they got involved.
Both fishing and on the cannery side of it?
Yes.
We'll continue our conversation with the co-authors of Terminal Island, Lost Communities on America's Edge, also another beautiful job with the graphic design of the book by Amy Inouye, who did my book many years ago for Angel City Press, and she does such great work. This is no exception. The way the photographs are laid out and the early even charts that are included here of what it looked like, it's a beautiful book and just full of remarkable history of Los Angeles's Terminal Island. We'll be back with more for this Southern California History segment in just 1 minute. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Southern California history and a terrific new book, Terminal Island, Lost Communities on America's Edge. We're talking with the co-authors, Naomi Hirahara and Geraldine Natz. I was just mentioning how great the book looks. Eric Linksweiler is the photography editor. The foreword by our good friend of Air Talk and someone that we consult with a lot for our Southern California history segments, William Deverell. Bill is so such a great resource, and we so appreciate all the work that he does with the Huntington USC Institute of the West. And George Takei does the afterword of the book as well. So it's a real group effort. Naomi, let's continue talking about the Japanese-American community. And then, of course, we have World War II, the bombing of Pearl Harbor. How rapidly does Terminal Island, the Japanese-American community, change?
Well, like other communities throughout California, the military zone, the leaders were picked up immediately after the bombing of Pearl Harbor. And it was obvious they were being surveilled because the FBI knew who to pick up. But I think what was especially tragic about the Terminal Island situation was on February 2nd, 1942, all the Japanese fishermen were picked up. And from there, they were taken to Department of Justice detention camps. And many of them were in very cold areas like North Dakota. And so you have these fishermen, you know, they usually wear sandals, you know, it's sandy. and they're suddenly in a place that's very snowy. And another, I think, really challenging thing is the families had no idea where the patriarch was. So there was no kind of communication. And so now in Terminal Island, after February 2nd, you have a bunch of families without the patriarch and the mother with all the children trying to figure out what is our next move. And then later that month, everyone on Terminal Island, including non-Japanese, were given a notice that they would have to leave the area within 48 hours by February 27th.
And is this in part at least because it's becoming part of the military
yes.
apparatus
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
as the U.S. Enters World War II with the front with the Japanese? Yeah.
So now the Japanese-American families move to, quote, the mainland. And then, of course, they're going to get a notice again that they have to go into camps or move
like
into
Manzanar
the interior.
Like Manzanar and
yes.
other places.
And most of them did go to Manzanar.
All right. So this community, which had been so vibrant, just, I mean, within months, it sounds like, just vanishes because the U.S. government orders everyone out and sends them to camps.
Yeah. What actually is incredible about And there's an actual group called the Terminal Islanders, and they get together like two times a year. And when I was a reporter and went to one of the events, I was just so surprised. They're so congenial, lively, and I think a lot of it is because of their upbringing. And this is and the descendants, they're still so close to one another. And I think it's because of the living situation. Because of their shared Wakayama heritage, they had their own kind of little language. They really depended on each other, and fishing was one of the most dangerous occupations out there. So even though it was very beautiful, I mean, beautiful in the sense of being by the water,
yeah,
although it smelled kind of bad to the mainlanders.
Yeah, picture without all the warehouses.
Yeah, exactly, and
now.
The smell. It was very fishy. But they just leaned on each other, and that still continues today. And you know, Geraldine was so helpful in making that that memorial space, and the Terminal Islanders helped raise the money. So even though everything was kind of ripped away from them, this kind of spirit endures. And I know the rest of Californians can't see that spirit. You know, it may be invisible to them, but it still exists. And I think it has some lessons for, you know, all of us.
Well, and this is one of the great values of the book, is that it has these photos of families, of the community leaders, of the fishing, of all what this community represented, and what it looked like then. Because frankly, it's very difficult when you drive on there now, you were alluding to this, to picture what it was like, even with the photos. I'm trying to, in my mind, juxtapose this, you know, this current warehouse that I'm seeing and parking lot next to it with what it would have looked like back many decades ago. Geraldine, aside from this book, what are some of the other recommendations that you make to people who want to get a sense of what this community represented?
Well, you know, of course, the book is a great resource, but actually just about a week ago, the Port of Los Angeles released a new film called The Smell of Money. And it's about the fishing industry. And so that smell that Naomi just mentioned, how everything smelled fishy because of when the canneries were processing, that smell would permeate all of Terminal Island and even into San Pedro. So people can find that on YouTube if they want to learn more about it. It talks about the development of the canneries and the Japanese community, but not in, you know, it doesn't cover the Japanese in as much detail as the book does. I think the other thing that was a big eye-opener for a lot of people was the fact that when the railroad came to Terminal Island, you know, what the railroad decided to do in the 1890s was create resorts down there. So I think one of the shockers in this book was for everyone to see the pictures of these big mansions right along the surf, because all of the movers and shakers in Los Angeles, you know, downtown Los Angeles had their summer homes on Terminal Island. And you know, as the, you know, what's interesting is this book is an evolution of those communities. So in 1912, when the you know they decided to start building Fish Harbor for the canneries, the squatters were evicted, and so that community changed. And then once the harbor started developing and filling Terminal Island, and the waterfront homes were no longer on the waterfront anymore, those, you know, Los Angeles bigwigs, they sold those homes, and they were broken up into boarding houses. And so it became a working man's community, the towns of Brighton Beach and Terminal. And so these were the people that, along with the Japanese in World War II, all of those boarding houses and everything, they all also had to leave the island as well.
Geraldine, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it. Naomi, thank you as well for sharing this book, which is a remarkable slice of Los Angeles history, Terminal Island, Lost Communities on America's Edge, published by Angel City Press. We have another Southern California history segment next hour. It's the LA Times' Pat Morrison on the history of the LA River. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. We'll be back and tell you in just a moment what's coming the second hour.
The stakes to save the Colorado River are high.
So if there's no water, there's no water for everybody.
California and six other states on the river must reach a compromise, but they're divided. The fate of the river may come down to a 28-year-old.
This is a historic thing coming.
The people and the real human drama behind the historic negotiations. Listen to Imperfect Paradise, the Gen Z water dealmaker, wherever you get podcasts.
It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. I hope you're having a wonderful Monday. In case you're just joining us for this hour, as I said in the first hour, it's our 39th anniversary today. April 1st, 2024, Air Talk turns 39. We began the program April 1st, 1985. I was 26 years old when we started the show. And here we are, nearly four decades later, to my knowledge, the longest running program of its kind, daily talk show in Los Angeles history. And it's just a tremendous testament to the great work of all the producers over the many years of this program, the types of guests, the segment ideas that they've had, and the extremely loyal LAist and KPCC audience over all these years. So I thank you very much for allowing me to keep doing this work, which I have to say I enjoy as much, if not more now than at any time during the years that I've been doing it. I really love my work, and I love the people that I get to work with here at LAist 89.3. We turn our attention now to a look at census data, which shows, as well as Federal Reserve and other data, which shows Latino entrepreneurship continues to rise, especially compared with the overall U.S. population. This not a surprise, as particularly Latino immigrant entrepreneurialism has been a fixture. That's something that Latino immigrants have brought from a variety of different countries and in a variety of different kinds of work. But we're seeing that continue to grow. And joining us is senior special writer for the Wall Street Journal, where she covers small business and entrepreneurship, Ruth Simon. Her latest piece titled "Latinos Are Starting U.S. Businesses at a Torrid Pace." Ruth, thank you so much. It's good to have you with us today. Just share with us the stats. What are we seeing in the way of that growth in Latino entrepreneurialism?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me, and happy anniversary.
Thank you.
What we are seeing is this continued increase in Latino entrepreneurship. And a couple things really struck me when I was looking at the data, that we're seeing that Latin American immigrants are starting businesses at more than twice the rate of the U.S. population as a whole. And the other thing that was very interesting is we saw this burst of entrepreneurship in the early days of the pandemic. But what we're seeing now is that this Latino entrepreneurship continues to grow, even as some of this other entrepreneurship among other groups has leveled off.
And as you dig into the statistics, I know you were looking at census data and digging this out, I guess, with Rob Fairley as well at the Journal. What did you find about the drivers of this? Do we have a good explanation, you know, aside from ambition, that's driving this?
Well, I think there are probably a lot of drivers. One is ambition. One may be necessity, too. I think if you think about people who are coming to this country, there is this drive, but language barriers or difficulty in transferring a professional degree may make it hard to get a job. The unemployment rate for Latinos is higher than for whites. And then one of the other things that Rob Fairley and I talked about was that many of these businesses that these folks are starting are in areas where we've seen a lot of growth since the pandemic. You think about services, food, and delivery. Those are sectors where we have seen growth. I do want to say, though, that we see entrepreneurship in all kinds of areas. So in my story, I talked to a number of people who were starting food businesses, but I also talked to people in healthcare and entertainment and other areas for my reporting.
We're talking with Ruth Simon of the Wall Street Journal, where she's senior special writer, and she covers small business and entrepreneurship. Also with us is Arturo Cazares, who is CEO of the Latino Business Action Network. It's based in San Jose, and they're a nonprofit that, with Stanford, puts out a report annually on the state of Latino entrepreneurship. Arturo, thank you for being with us today.
Yes, hi. Thank you for having me.
What are you seeing in terms of the rate of growth of entrepreneurship in the most recent report with Stanford?
Yes, of course. As Ruth was commenting, there's just across-the-board growth from Latinos in terms of entrepreneurship. What we're seeing overall, this is immigrants and non-immigrant Latinos as a whole, are growing the number of businesses by 57% from 2007 until 2022. That compares to white-owned businesses' growth of 5%. So it's a much faster growth rate for Latino businesses. Also, there's already over 5 million Latino-owned businesses in the country, and the number of businesses is growing at a much faster rate.
Well, yeah, and of course the population that's here, I'm assuming, is much bigger than the first generation immigrant population, and yet we're seeing an even higher rate from immigrants. Is that right?
Yes, and so about just under a third of the Latinos in the U.S. are immigrants, but about half of those Latino-owned businesses are led by Latino immigrants.
So that's a big difference, yeah.
Exactly. Some of that might be the demographics, in that we would need to compare the amount of adults that, because most businesses are led by adults. So we should really compare the number of adults that are immigrant Latinos versus the number of adults that are U.S.-born Latinos. But yes, your point is correct that Latinos immigrants are over-indexing. And I do think it goes back to what Ruth was suggesting, that there's the issues of not being able to transfer perhaps degrees that you had from the home country, or just difficulties getting jobs. Sometimes it could be the documentation status as well could make it harder to get a job versus you could start a business.
I also wonder about, you know, for immigrant families who come to the United States and are going to be living almost certainly in close proximity with each other, would, even if they don't have access to large amounts of capital, that they might be able to multi-generationally pool money to start a small business. You know, how much of that are you seeing, that it's really the family that's putting sweat equity and whatever savings they might have into the start of these businesses?
Go ahead, Ruth. Sorry.
I was going to say, in talking to a lot of business owners, I saw a lot of families multi-generations working together to build the businesses. One of the things we have too that you bring up is this issue of access to capital. And it is an issue for many of these startups. We got some data from the Federal Reserve Banks, which found that 42% of startups with Hispanic owners were denied credit, compared to 25% of startups with white owners. And so I think sweat equity is really important, and capital can be hard to get.
That's Ruth Simon, The Wall Street Journal. Arturo, your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that. We saw something similar. I would say, though, regardless of the ethnicity of the business owners, when you're starting a business, sweat equity is one
That's
of the key.
That's what it requires, yeah.
Absolutely. But I do think that, to your point, Latinos are maybe have a harder time having access to capital, but are usually part of larger family structures. And so they do leverage that more to get their businesses going. Now, those families have lower wealth to begin with, so they're kind of forced into that situation. What we do see when we compare, for example, the number of the loan acceptance rates, we can compare Latino business owners with that have the same or better metrics than a white business owner, and they're still about 60% less likely to get the most favorable loan conditions. And so there is a gap that's maybe have to do with some structural biases and perhaps even subconscious biases that might exist in the system, because that's quite a large gap. And well, so that does force Latinos to rely on sweat equity more.
Yeah, and I was going to say, we have so many examples, and I know they're anecdotal, but of a generation that comes to the United States, and they start with a small business, and of course it grows from there, and the kids work in the business, and the next thing you know, it's a big business. And you know, we see so many examples of that among Latinos who, you know, when it started very small, whether, you know, it's a restaurant or, you know, distribution or whatever the business is, and then see it take off. What do you think are some of the key factors that immigrants need to sort of fight through, aside from the access to capital, to be able to sustain a business over time and to grow it? Arturo?
Yes. And so, well, in general, what we're seeing is that Latino businesses are growing, and they're growing faster than the average. So when we looked at the 3-year compounded annual growth rate, the median growth for Latino businesses was 8.7% versus white-owned businesses at 5.6% annually. And so that's about a 50% faster growth rate per company, in addition to there's more Latino companies now. And we see similar growth factors for immigrant Latinos. So they are finding success. They are finding ways to grow it. I think it is that sweat equity. Also, what we see is that Latino business owners tend to be a little more innovative or adaptable. That maybe is a different way to look at the same phenomena. And we see it in different ways. Latino businesses are faster to use AI. When we did a survey, it was almost double the rate that Latino business owners were using AI. Also, Latino businesses are faster to make marketing changes in how they approach trying to reach customers. And then the final sort of innovation or just reaction to changes when the pandemic hit, our data showed that Latino business owners were faster to pivot. Sometimes maybe it's because they had to. If Latino businesses, especially immigrant businesses, tend to over-index on food, services, and construction. And if you recall, during the pandemic, those two areas were hit massively.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that forced that community to really redirect. And so that does push them to be very dynamic and innovative.
Well, and the other thing is there's probably a self-selecting part of this. Again, for the first generation Latino immigrants, this wouldn't necessarily hold true with multiple generations, except it would have been modeled with earlier generations. The resiliency required to get to the United States, to establish oneself here, Arturo, though, I mean, you've already, you know, crossed a bar that's a barrier to many people to even restarting a life here. So you've been able to do that if you get to the U.S., and that has to help with one's confidence that you can meet the challenge ahead.
Absolutely. And I think that in general, anyone who goes into a business has to have that kind of faith that you would, an immigrant has to have when they decide to leave their country to come to the United States. But yes, because it's by definition, if you're an immigrant, you actually went through that process, it probably does predispose you to dealing with these kinds of changes and being more confident as you approach it. Having said that, these businesses do need support and better processes, right? Because we do see a lot of unfairness that they're facing at times when it comes to access to capital, which could make it easier. And the bottom line is that they're creating jobs at a very rapid rate, and those jobs employ all Americans, not just Latinos. Mm-hmm. So there's an interest beyond Latinos to address some of these gaps that these Latino business owners are facing, because our metrics show they more than doubled the number of jobs in Latino-owned companies in that same period of 2007 to 2022, which is much faster than the overall growth of businesses creating jobs. So it is something that we want to continue to explore and look at, is how do we continue to support this growth, because it really is needed by our economy overall.
We're talking with Arturo Casares, who's CEO of the Latino Business Action Network, the nonprofit based in San Jose. Arturo, what is being done, or what do you and your organization think should be done to improve that access to capital for Latino-owned businesses?
Yeah, and so we're not bankers, nor are we VCs, venture capitalists, and so we would not propose to tell bankers or venture capitalists how to do their business. But what we do encourage them to do is to look at their own processes, because it essentially means they're leaving money on the table. There's real opportunity. These our data shows the metrics are actually good around Latino business owners, and so you do want to be investing and loaning to them, as opposed to maybe, you know, you're taking higher risks in other areas because you're not investing properly in Latinos. So there's money for them on their bottom line if they look at their processes. The very tactical thing that we do is we partner with all of them. We invite all of them to work with us. We look at our data as helping people see opportunities, and we expect most people, when they see those opportunities, will do the right thing. And we approach all the banks and VCs that we engage with that attitude, that we can connect them with. We work with literally thousands of businesses we can connect them to. It's more than data that we do. We have business scaling programs for mm-hmm. Latino owners, for startups at Stanford University. Our research is done through Stanford
That's
as well.
Great.
So we bring all that to bear when we talk about this opportunity with anyone who's interested.
We're talking with Arturo Casares, Latino Business Action Network. Ruth Simon of the Wall Street Journal, a senior special writer. You tell some great stories about what Arturo was talking about, the creativity and the ingenuity that many Latino entrepreneurs bring to their work. One of them you highlighted as a guy who came up with freeze-dried meals that are geared toward the outdoor market, hikers and people, using foods that are popular in countries in Latin America and Mexico and the like. I mean, that's just a great example of that. Elaborate, please.
Yes, this is a company called Oso Adventure Meals. And I spoke with one of the co-founders who said he came up with the idea while he was hiking during the pandemic. And his thought was to take his grandmother's recipes and try to translate those into these meals that hikers or climbers, outdoor adventurers could take with them to be more tasty. and to really bring his culture. And I think that's one of the things when you think about entrepreneurship, it's what can you bring differently? Is there a market that you can tap that no one realized is out there? Now, one of his challenges is the founders are from immigrant families and they have raised some capital. They started off getting money through a Kickstarter campaign, but scaling to that next level has been hard, and they're working hard on that.
And there's always the challenge that a bigger company is going to look at the idea that the smaller person's company, you know, smaller company came up with, and, oh, yeah, that is a good, we hadn't thought of that. And then, you know, they take it on with their bigger distribution network, and the good idea, you know, goes to profit someone else. But thank you so much, Ruth, for talking with us about the article you wrote, Latinos Are Starting U.S. Businesses at a Torrid Pace. We appreciate you joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Ruth Simon, senior special writer, Wall Street Journal. She covers small business and entrepreneurship. And our thanks to Arturo Casares, CEO of the Latin Business Action Network based in San Jose. Coming up, the Los Angeles River. Pat Morrison with her wonderful book, Rio LA, Tales from the Los Angeles River. It's our second Southern California history segment today. Pat will share her expertise on the evolution of the river from being a vital source of water for the earliest residents of Los Angeles to a channelized flood control part of Los Angeles life, and now efforts to restore it to a much more natural state. We'll be back with Pat in just a minute.
Hey, it's Brian, the host of How to LA, a podcast that is a love letter to Los Angeles. Independent movie theaters are having a glow-up moment.
Vidi, it's an Eagle Rock, amazing. We have our friends at the American Cinematheque. The Vista just reopened.
In our new series, Revival House, we'll take you inside these spots and share their history. Because movie history is LA history. Listen to Revival House on How to LA wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us. A little bit later this hour, we'll open up the phones for you to share your favorite interaction with the LA River. Maybe you walk or cycle along part of the river path, or you've really discovered it as a place to go in the midst of the city to relax, get closer to nature for those portions of the river that are a more natural setting. But I'd be interested in hearing what you have to say about it later. But for this Southern California history segment, we talk about the evolution of the river from its very wild state to its much more contained, largely concrete channeled self. With us, Pat Morrison, Los Angeles Times columnist and author of Rio LA, Tales from the Los Angeles River, a must read for those interested in the history of this river so central to the founding of the city of Angels. Pat, great to have you with us this morning.
Larry, thank you so much.
So let's talk about the earliest wild state of the LA River, because I have to say, for so many people, even those who've grown up here, let alone those that migrated to Los Angeles, they had no sense of how important the river was to the earliest inhabitants.
Well, that's all true. And when I was thinking of talking to you, I realized it's going to be April Fool's Day. And in the 50s and 60s, once the river was paved, you know, there would occasionally be press announcements or news releases saying, we're starting up cruises on the Los Angeles River. And these were all, of course, April Fool's stunts. But here's the thing. It's April Fool's Day, but I didn't come on here to talk about the river. This is a non-hostile takeover of your show, because today is the 39th anniversary of Air Talk, and I've been working with your producers. And for the next half hour or so, we're going to hear from your listeners about what Air Talk means to them. Larry Mantle is speechless, ladies and gentlemen. Note the time and the date. So if listeners have a story to share about your connection with this program, share it. Call 866, I get to say it now, 866-893-5722. That's the number to call to tell Larry what his program for 39 years has meant to you.
You got me, Pat. All of you got me. Wow. I was totally blindsided.
Right now.
And I see people lining up on the phone. Oh, my goodness. Pat, I don't know what to say. Thank you.
Well, Larry, this has been a long time in the planning, and it was very hush-hush. Everybody who was in on it knew that this was absolutely need to know, and you were not in the loop.
Not at all.
I don't know how they did it, but congratulations to them for managing to do it. And congratulations, Larry. I mean, this show has just been so seminal to what LA has grown into and become, how it's perceived itself over decades. That's plural, decades. It's so significant. And, you know, in the early 21st century, I would pop in and sub for you when you were on vacation.
Yeah.
Or off. And that was so much fun. And eventually got my own program there on KPCC, which was loads of fun being, you know, sharing the studio with you, you know, handing off during the weekdays. And it was such a pleasure and an honor to do that. And now, you know, and I hope you're going to be hearing in the next few minutes from listeners who tell you just what a mark you have made in their lives. And equally as important, in the life of the city, and giving the city a mirror to look at itself and sometimes give itself a little kick in the keister and sometimes give itself a pat on the back.
I'm overwhelmed. Now, I'm being told by the producers we have a clip that needs to be played. We'll hear that now.
Hi, Larry. It's Drew Carey here. April Fools, you're fired. Just kidding, of course. We're celebrating your 39th anniversary here at LAist and KPCC, and I'm so glad to be a part of it. You know, I love your show, and I really love you as a person. I'm glad I got to meet you and your lovely wife and hang out with you and talk to you outside the studio. You are such an interesting person, and it shows because your show is so eclectic with it, and you're always looking for new things and talking to new people about different things, and you're so honestly curious and fair with everybody. I've never heard you phone it in one time, man. Honestly, you are the best. Keep up the good fight. Keep being curious. Keep asking smart questions. Keep being kind to all your guests, no matter what their views. And yeah, just keep on keeping on, man. You're the greatest. I love you. Take care.
Oh, Drew, thank you so much for that. Wow, a total turn as we look at the 39th anniversary of Air Talk. Wow, I had no idea this was coming. And I see Xavier Yaroslavsky, the director of the LA Institute at UCLA's Luskin School of Public Affairs, is on the line along with Pat Morrison. Zev, of course, for many years, Los Angeles County Supervisor. Prior to that, Los Angeles City Council member. Zev, good morning.
Good morning, and happy anniversary.
Thank you, Zev.
It's a miracle that they kept it from you because they shared the information with me, and I, you know, I can't keep my mouth shut. So
you didn't let on.
I didn't let on. It was close, but I hung in there. I just want to say, echo what Pat said and Drew Carey said. You are the chronicler of 40 years of LA history, and you know, I teach my history students at UCLA about the importance of primary sources. You are the primary source about what's happened in LA in these last four decades. I call you the Walter Cronkite of LA journalism. And the reason I do that is I remember you doing an interview, and the person shall remain nameless as to who the interview was with. But you are such a class act. You never lose your temper on the air. But this particular instance, you were being given the runaround by the interviewee. And finally, you didn't lose it, but you kind of got angry. And I turned to a friend of mine who was sitting next to me, and I said, when you've lost Larry Mantle, you've lost Los Angeles. And that's what LBJ said about Walter Cronkite. When you've lost Cronkite, you've lost America. So I just thank you for being who you are, you do your homework. I've seen that. You gave me the opportunity by going on vacation once to substitute for you, and I got to interview Vin Scully on your radio.
I remember that.
Half an hour. And it was the thrill of a lifetime because, as you know, my real ambition in life was to be the voice of the Los Angeles Dodgers, and it It's a good thing I didn't hang around waiting for Vince Scully to retire.
Well, you had your own place in the life of the county and the city, Zev, and made a remarkable contribution, which you continue, of course, with the research and work you do with your students at the LA Initiative at Lusk and at UCLA. Zev, thank you. I so appreciate all the support you always give and your kind words. It's very, very meaningful to me, and I appreciate all the years of all the interviews back when you were an elected official and of course, all our conversations that we've had in the years since your retirement from that. Thanks so much.
Well, feeling is mutual, Larry. Happy anniversary.
Thanks you so much. Zev Yaroslavsky, former L.A. County Supervisor, former Los Angeles City Council member. Why don't we take a listener call from Eileen in Sherman Oaks, calling in for this 39th anniversary today of Air Talk. Good morning, Eileen.
Hi, Larry. I absolutely, positively need your show in my heart and my mind every day. It is critical to me for just having a perfect balance between news and culture and humanity. I've listened to you since the beginning. I'm distressed, I must say to you in all candor, that you moved the show an hour earlier since I sleep late because I stay up late. But at least I get to hear the second hour.
And the podcast.
I must tell you in all candor that that I panic, that based on certain things like only being on 4 days a week and making the show earlier, I panic that you're going to retire. That would diminish my relationship with LA and the universe profoundly, because you are a superb journalist, but you are also a superb human being.
Eileen, thank you. That is so kind. And let me assure you, I have no plans to retire in the immediate future by any means. I've told management here that my intention is to continue for at least a few more years, and we'll see. But at this point, the cutting down to 4 days a week was really with the idea of prolonging my tenure on the air, because doing 5 days a week and all the topics every day is just so demanding, as you can imagine. The prep more than the hosting, it's just the prep for all the segments. And so this was to allow me to ease back a little bit. And Austin does such a great job on Fridays. And I'm still on, of course, with Film Week after that, which we record. So my hope was that taking the Fridays off of the air in terms of my live presence would prolong my time of hosting Air Talk. So, Eileen, I'm not planning to go anywhere in the foreseeable future. We'll see down the road, and my health is good, and I love working with the team. As I said earlier, they weren't born when the show started, and I learned so much from them, and they just have so much to share with me, and I enjoy the energy, the commitment that they bring, the open-mindedness, the growth that they represent. I feel like we're all learning together, and I certainly have no intention at this point of leaving the air. Eileen, thank you so much, and with me, a colleague of mine, who is the former senior producer of Air Talk, who just a wonderful person to get to work with, and she now is the producer for our weekend news programming here, Fiona Ng. Fiona, good to have you with us.
Oh, my God, Larry, I am so happy for you. Happy birthday.
Show birthday, yes, thank you.
Oh, my God, I just want to also shout out to Pat Morrison, who's on the line. Just want to say, so lucky to be able to work with you, Larry, and also Pat. You guys are both legends. But I just remember, when I left the show, I wrote this in an all-staff note that I came in as a really good producer, joining Air Talk as an associate producer, eventually leading the show. But I just want to say I came out as a better person, and that is all to your credit. You have been an amazing role model, and I learn from you every day, and I continue to do so I just want to tell Los Angeles, being a former senior producer means that sometimes I get to go to a bar and have a drink with Larry. So eat your heart out, you guys.
We'll have another one soon. Fiona, thank you so much. And one of the things I love is that I've stayed friends with all of our senior producers, Linda Othen and Gerard, who led our program for 20 years before she retired, and just such a wonderful job, and Lauren Olson and Fiona Ng and Megan Nguyen, and now Matt D'Angelo-Antonio, so many terrific people that I've had the honor of working with. We're going to take a break. In case you tuned in to hear our conversation with Pat Morrison about the history of the LA River, the whole program was taken and turned into a look at the history of Air Talk, its 39th anniversary. And Pat put the call out to listeners to share your thoughts about 39 years of Air Talk. We're at 866-893-5722. A longtime Film Week critic, Tim Cogshell's on the line. We'll hear from him. All of this set up, totally unbeknownst to me. I had no idea until Pat broke the embargo on this and told me what's happening, what we're doing. I haven't been this surprised since my son Desmond, when he was little, took over the opening of our Film Week program on one of our anniversaries of Air Talk. Jeffrey in Hollywood says, I moved back to L.A. in August, started listening to Air Talk and LAist. It's been a wonderful addition to my life in Los Angeles and helps me understand more about the city. Jeffrey, thank you so much. We'll be back in just 90 seconds. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. On this 39th anniversary of Air Talk, the whole show got taken over. Pat Morrison, who was ostensibly on to talk about her book Rio LA and the history of the LA River, came on to tell me just minutes ago that instead our production team on Air Talk has been talking with a variety of people to have them call in and talk about Air Talk's 39-year history on this day of our anniversary. We started on April 1st, 1985, and so I got totally fooled on this April Fool's. I had no idea this was coming, and so I'm just going to follow what our Air Talk producers are telling me. So they have given me some prompts to put out for listeners to call in. What's one of your most moving or memorable interviews in our history of Air Talk? It can be from a recent segment or from years ago. I'll tell you what mine are. But if you would like to share that with us as well, you can do that. So I'll answer some of these questions, but you can also share for you. Liz in Southgate, who frequently calls into the program and always with really good questions. And Liz shares personal experiences that are relevant to things we're talking about. And I always appreciate her input. She said, I've been a listener since I graduated high school in 2002. I enjoy how local the program is because so much news isn't local anymore. So true, Liz. And thank you so much because you make a contribution with your calls to the program. Tim Cogshell, who's been a critic with us on Film Week for so long and such an important voice for us here on LAS. Tim, good morning. Thank you for taking part in this.
Hey, Larry, it's Tim from North Hollywood.
Oh, Tim from North Hollywood. Thank you. You're on Air Talk.
But that's who I was from about 1993 until right before you so graciously invited me to be a part of Film Week. I was Tim from North Hollywood calling the show, talking to you about every subject that was on there. And then our Wade Major introduced me to you, and you invited me to be on the show back in 2010. And it's just been an absolutely transformative thing in my life, my career as a film critic. It's just been fantastic. I loved the show before I was a part of it, and to be a part of it is just astounding. I don't know if you remember this, Larry, but on May 11th, 2012, for whatever reason, the other critics didn't show up. It was just you and me. And we did that whole Film Week together. The main movie that day was Dark Shadows, Johnny Depp's Dark Shadows.
We kicked
that movie for about 6 minutes. You and I. And it was so great because you, Larry, as is usually the case, had watched almost as many movies as I had.
Tim, there is no critic.
We did the whole show.
No critic I would have rather been in that situation with than you, because you're so quick on your feet and able to come in and talk, and so wide-ranging on film topics. And I do have a vague memory memory of that, and I guess it worked. I know certainly that you would have a lot to talk about and could fill that time. Tim, thank you so much. I enjoy working with you and with the other critics so much. It's just, it's a weekly pleasure. I look forward to it every week when we get together and record the program. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Tim in North Hollywood, our Film Week critic with us. Let me share some of the written comments that have come in. John in Mid-City says, I work from home every day. I just love listening to the program. There are always so many interesting topics and guests. I've only been in L.A. for 7 years, but for someone new in the community, it's been a great entry for me. John, I appreciate that. Mary in Minneapolis, a former Orange County resident. I love this. I love Larry Mantle. It's going to be a sad day when Larry retires. Happy April Fools. Mary, thank you so much. No retirement plans in the foreseeable future. I'm sure it'll come at some point, but hopefully a ways off. Mary emailed, one of the best parts about retiring last year is now I can listen to Larry and Air Talk Live. Mary, thank you very much. Andrew Tenorio in Santa Monica said, Air Talk and Larry is the sound of home. It's made me feel connected to the city and my community. Whenever I'm abroad and feel homesick, it's always nice to hear Larry's voice and the goings-on back in L.A. It's hard for me to express how touched I am. I'm trying to keep it together because this takeover of Air Talk by our producers and by with people that I've known for so many years and who I regard so highly has shocked me, and I had no idea this was coming, but I just can't tell you how much I appreciate it. Let's talk with Carolyn in Altadena. Carolyn, good to have you with us.
Hi there, Larry. I want to say my last name because my husband is part of my thank you. My husband was Anderson, and I'm holding a cassette from April 18th, 2001, where you had interviewed him. He was a Celtic neuroscientist. He studied the brain, but also was at that point studying autism. And that's what that recording is from.
Yeah.
He died 10 years ago. And what got, I think, both of us through that was you. Hearing your voice, feeling connected to the outside world, but hearing your really humane approach, your really dedicated and caring approach to what was going on, not only in our city, but in culture and arts and science. And I was very, very tired at that time, and I would wait for your show, and I would turn it on, and I would just feel like, okay, life is continuing, you know. So my husband unfortunately died of brain cancer 10 years ago, and he did a clinical trial and he had surgery, and that unfortunately left him paralyzed, and he couldn't read anymore, but he could listen. So your show was this lifeline for both of us, and it really helped me. It really helped me a lot. And I, of course, still listen today, but I felt grateful at that time.
Carolyn,
so thank you so much.
Carolyn, thank you. I'm almost speechless, and I'm so sorry about Paul's passing, but I can't tell you how much it means to me to hear that we were the source of some comfort going through that just incredibly difficult time. Carolyn, thank you so much. I understand that we have other recordings to share. Evelyn, the next one.
Hi, I'm Larry's son, Desmond Mantle, and I'm with my mom, Kristen Mantle.
Hello. When I met Larry, he had had the show for a few years, but I hadn't heard it yet. I knew his name from the door at PCC College, and I loved how kind and honest he was and how fun he was to be with. And when I heard the show, I heard those same qualities on air. Over the years, all the growth and changes the station and the show has gone through, those are the constants. Larry's kindness and the fun it is to listen to him talk and to hear him ask questions.
When I first met Larry, I was 0 days old and had no ability to form memories yet. But as soon as I could form memories, the memories I formed were of my dad having a remarkable number of answers to my childhood questions and of asking me a lot of questions of his own. His curiosity helped instill curiosity in me and made me feel like even as a very young man, I could develop the kind of knowledge that would allow me to succeed in the world, and that he would respect that, despite being older than I am. Congratulations on 39 years, Dad.
We love you.
Well, thank you, Kristen and Desmond. Kristen asked me this morning, oh, are you doing anything special for the 39th anniversary? I said, no, I think for the 40th, there are, you know, plans to do something. But no, I'm just going to mention it on the air. Little did I know the takeover of Air Talk from our producers and other guests would take place. This is just absolutely amazing. And in fact, I've lost track of the schedule. Do I need to take another break at this point? I forgot. Okay, we'll do, all right, we'll do it later. Sorry, I'm a little overwhelmed. And let's see, we have Justin K. Thompson. Oh, wow, director of Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. Thank you. Justin, go right ahead.
Hi, Larry. How you doing?
I'm doing all right.
Justin. Yeah, I just wanted to call and say thanks for 39 brilliant years, you know. I've been listening since I was a teenager. My dad used to listen to the radio, and I've been hearing your voice. And I've just always been so amazed. You've always had such a knack for encouraging the most interesting dialogues with your guests and bringing out an insightful perspective to any topic. And, you know, growing up in Los Angeles, I've always especially appreciated how often you focused on topics that were specific to our city. News and ideas and thoughts and people that weren't being covered anywhere else. So you really helped me understand my own city and helped me understand the people that I'm surrounded by that make us who we are. So, and giving me that insight and perspective. So thank you so much. Congratulations,
Justin.
Larry.
Thank you so much, Justin. That means a great deal to me. Thank you so much. A very talented director, Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, Justin K. Thompson. Patricia in Manhattan Beach, good to have you with us on this 39th anniversary of Air Talk.
Well, Mr. Mantle, I want to thank you personally, but also professionally. When I moved back to Los Angeles in 1999, I had been an NPR supporter and listener for many years, so I started hunting around and found your show. Not too long after that, I got a job at the L.A. Superior Court in the Media Relations Department. And I liked your show so much, when something would come up, I'd say, well, why don't you, put the judge on, put the presiding judge on. And they go, oh, no, they never do that. You know, that's a call-in show. It's just asking for trouble. We're not going to do it. Well, the years roll on, and they roll on, and they roll on. Finally, there's an issue that they do want to have you hear about and discuss, and they do go on. And it was such a success that thereafter, when your producers would call, I think most of the time they would come on the show. As a side note, I think that their interest in the courts through your producing team, subsequently is responsible for the great coverage on the judicial election candidates.
Oh, our LAS team does.
And really neat.
They do a great job on the voter game plan. Patricia, thank you so much for that. I appreciate it. Also with us, Oscar, Tony-nominated actor, so many different roles. One of the most recent, Winning Time, The Rise of the Lakers Dynasty, the HBO series. John C. Reilly. John, good morning.
Good morning, Larry. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm still in shock, but I'm doing great.
I know. It's incredible how much attention you usually give to other people. And this morning, it's all coming back to you. I just wanted to be one of the chorus of voices to call in and say, first of all, professionally as a film actor, I want to say I really appreciate how much you love movies and how much you promote film and talk about it on the show. And as a person, I just wanted to say thank you so much for caring about people. It doesn't matter what the subject is when your show's on, like somehow you make us care about the people that you're talking to. And I don't think there's a way to fake that. So I want to say thank you for caring about people, Larry, and thank you for 39 years of amazing radio.
John, thank you. It means so much to me. I appreciate that and always look forward to your visits on the program. Thank you so much. John C. Reilly, and, every day that I come in here, I feel a tremendous sense of responsibility to you as a listener of the program. And there'd be no way I could mail it in because, you know, it's too exciting for me. I want to get into these topics in a way that hopefully is deep and of interest, and I'm interested in doing. That's why we're doing the topic. I feel it's either important or of interest, or producers have shared something with me that I was not aware of at all, but I want to learn more about and to hear from them what it's about. And then it's just a great experience to get to do that. Lucy in Pasadena says, during the pandemic, I bought a little transistor radio from Amazon, and every day during the pandemic, I would listen to Air Talk and Larry Mantle. It was a lifesaver. Lucy, thank you so much for that. Linda Othen and Gerard, 20 years, our senior producer. She's the first senior producer on Air Talk and really set the course of so much that would follow later. As she said, I want to congratulate you on 39 years of incredible radio. You're still bringing it every day with the same brilliant thoughtfulness, sincerity, and dedication that you've had since the first day I walked into the studio to see the show. Thanks for all you give us. Linda, thank you so much. And you had such a huge role in establishing those early years of Air Talk and building this program over two decades. Kristen in Newport Beach emailed, I started listening in about 2005. I've moved up and down the West Coast over the intervening years and have always listened on the app or online when I can't listen on the airwaves. Larry is my intellectual crush. My day isn't complete without him and Air Talk. I think I'll have to leave Orange County when Larry finally retires because SoCal just won't be the same. Kristen, thank you so much. Dave in Chatsworth, I've been listening since when you were on in the afternoon. Will never forget coming home one weekday while listening to a show about sex and hearing women on air, a woman on air saying how much she enjoyed it. When I walked in the house, I realized it was my wife on the phone with you. What a great one to close on. Thank you so much. And Sam in Echo Park says, Air Talk means consistency during a time when nothing is consistent. I always know I can listen to Air Talk. It's the one thing I can rely on. Sam, thank you so much. So many wonderful comments. I don't have time to share them all on air. I will read all of them. And my thanks to our Air Talk producers and all the wonderful listeners and notables who shared with us what 39 years of Air Talk means. Thanks so much. I can't retire now. We'll keep going. Have a great rest of your day from all of us at Air Talk.